The Bible does not prescribe any specific economic ideology. Ancient Israel was largely a barter economy, which over the centuries slowly transformed itself into an urban and trading economy. What the Bible does instead is to demand or encourage a specific code of conduct for all who deal commercially with each other. Just weights and just measures. You shall not deal deceitfully or falsely one with another. The Bible is full of rules of this kind. When you make a loan of any sort to your neighbor, you must not enter his house to seize his pledge. You must remain outside. The man to whom you made the loan brings the pledge out to you. If he is a needy man, he shall not go to sleep on his pledge. You must return the pledge to him at sundown, so he may sleep in his clothes and bless you. Be your merit before the Lord your God. To explain, a man's home was his very private domain. No economic reason allows you to violate it. You do nothing to intrude on his dignity or his home. Most people at that time were poor. They owned, many of them, only the cloak that conveniently covered them during the night. The law that you must return a man's pledge, that is his cloak, to him each night, so they may sleep in his cloth, recognizes his cloak is his bedding, and his alone. Returning it each night was the only moral thing to do. What appears in all such maxims is a strong concern for the other person. When a rabbi looks at the economy, he is therefore not examining it in terms of its adherence to some fiscal ideology, but in terms of its usefulness, providing a sufficiency of necessary goods and services to those who are engaged in it. And at the very least, it must be an economy which gives to everyone a fair share of opportunity, and to the indigent, food, clothing, and shelter. In these regards, our economy is giving off different, even contradictory signals. On the one hand, per capita disposable income is up. Indeed, it has been climbing constantly since the mid-1970s. On the other hand, the percentage of families living below the poverty line in the United States has increased over the same period of time. Since 1981, the year the present administration took office, inflation has cooled, the annual expansion of goods and services has increased, joblessness has fallen to its lowest rate in a decade, interest rates have declined, and many have more money to spend. On the other hand, there's more family poverty, savings have fallen sharply, trade has deteriorated until there's an imbalance of $15 to $17 billion a month, and the annual budget gap has risen significantly, from $72 billion in 1980 to $148 billion this last year. Two tax cuts have reduced the income tax on the wealthiest from 70% to 32%. Taxes were reduced for everyone, of course, but the proportion of tax reduction for the wealthy was out of proportion to cuts for others. Furthermore, the president has cut the amount of money requested for various welfare programs. In almost all domestic agencies, there have been cutbacks of services and therefore of their usefulness to the poor. The president's argument was that the more money in individual hands, particularly in the hands of the wealthy, would allow greater investment and encourage the whole economy. This has not happened. The level of personal investment in the economy is the same today as it was when he took office in 1981. And the economy has been in everybody's mind since Monday, November 19th, Black Monday, when the stock market dropped more than 500 points. That day, $2.2 trillion of equity was wiped out in one fell swoop. There is nothing like a crisis to fix one's mind squarely on a problem. As a result, the President and the Congress were forced to sit down to devise a budget-cutting package to chop off some $32 billion from the federal budget and at least satisfy the Graham Rudman requirements. As you know, they came up with a mundane and predictable counting which will somehow scrape $32 billion off this year's prepared budget, or seem to. The package was less than action-oriented economists had hoped for. $5 billion was taken off the defense budget. $5 or $6 billion in new taxes were invented, mostly corporate taxes. $5 billion would be taken in one-time revenue savings, and the rest of the cuts were left up to Congress. This was as much as a Congress and the administration, each facing an election next year, were willing to suggest. The president is determined not to raise taxes and to defend his defense budget. Congress is determined to protect public welfare legislation. So the cuts are minimal and to some degree simply window dressing. Both sides weren't willing to tackle the entitlement programs, which today represent a third of the national budget. This $32 billion compromise will probably not be enough to satisfy many here and abroad, but it's probably all that can be gotten for the moment. There's a broad consensus the United States economy is not what it used to be, and it isn't. At the end of the Second World War, and for some 15 to 20 years thereafter, the United States economy drove the free world's fiscal policies. Today, the American economy shares that responsibility with Japan and Germany and the other countries of the European Economic Community and the Asian Rim. Part of America's problems today are due to the fact that in the heyday of American domination, the American government undertook responsibilities which it can no longer discharge. We rebuilt Western Europe and Japan. We have 300,000 troops in Europe, another 50,000 still in Korea. We encouraged our big banks to lend money to the Third World, to Latin America, and to friendly governments here and there. At the same time, we paid too little attention to trade, to the need for a common economic policy to guarantee that our goods could find markets. When the post-war period began, there was no real competition. Business grew fat and lazy during that period. We thought of we had a lock on the world's markets until we were awakened to the root shock of the Japanese and German trade miracles. We forgot that there is nothing out of the ordinary about trade and manufacture. Anybody who wanted to make the effort could compete in the world. Japan is a highly disciplined and educated workforce who are soon outproducing us in television sets and cameras and other electronic equipment, even in steel and cars. Many of their products were superior to anything that the United States was producing. In the past 15 years or so, the United States has steadily been losing its capacity to compete in the world's markets. This change can be seen in our eroding market share in almost all sections of the international economy. Declining profitability in the late 60s and 1970s was in part due to the fact that American industry did not keep ahead of the game and didn't invest in research and development to the degree that it should. Manufacturers argued that we couldn't compete because of weigh scale differentials. But as the decades succeeded one another, these so-called wage differentials began to disappear. And today in Japan, for instance, the wage scale for certain industries is approximately that of the United States. The principal competitive thrust came not from our traditional rivals in Western Europe, but from those Asian countries with government-sponsored policies on trade, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, and Hong Kong. Their consistent trade policies and our inattention to basic problems accounts for part of the change. Another part of it was inevitable. The world does not stand still. All the countries of the world have a chance to develop a higher standard of living through trade and manufacture. If they want to make the effort, they can do it. Trade and manufacture have no real secrets. Others can produce iron and steel and lasers and computers. South Korea and Yugoslavia today produce cars that sell in the United States. Last week, the last ship to be produced in the United States was sent down the waves in Maine, while South Korea maintains today the world's largest shipbuilding, ship repair facilities. If they work hard and trade hard, other countries can take markets away from us, and they have. For many years, the United States accepted trade imbalances with other countries. We had such lead that it seemed almost ungracious not to do so. But in recent years, the loss of markets has become a real problem, and it's increasingly difficult to be so gracious. Protectionist legislation is beginning to ripple through Congress. Labor sees an opportunity to guarantee employment. Management sees an opportunity to avoid competition. It's very easy to find an excuse for protectionist legislation. The European community, and most especially Japan, have quotas and other restrictions on the sale of imports and trade policies which sometimes subsidize their goods in the world's markets. But for us to fall into the trap of protectionist legislation would not be the answer. The world economy depends upon trade, not upon restrictions against trade. We have to learn and to persuade others to adjust the national economic interest into a working international system. Protectionist legislation only disrupts the development of that international system and makes it more difficult to deliver goods and services to the points where they are needed. We live in a world economy today. For that economy to be successful, there must be free passage of goods between countries. And as more countries become part of the advanced world, there'll be more and more competition as each country seeks its own advantage and more protectionist legislation in some countries. Japan today is a classic example of a country which tried to restrict entry to its domestic economy. It succeeded for a while. But Japan is finding that very much more difficult now to do in a world where other still powerful economies exist, what she had done up till now. The American economy today is a vast and still powerful one. We represent 4% of the world's population and still consume 20% of the world's goods. Whether the figure can be maintained is another question. We've learned the hard way that there are sufficient competitors for every scrap of business we might seek. Japan, Taiwan, Korea challenge the United States not only on the basis of cheap goods produced by cheap labor, but on the basis of quality goods and highly skilled, well-paid labor. Japan and other countries on the Asian Rim and the countries of the European economic community have learned the value of economic planning, and we have not. And we have seen our business lose markets to other countries that manage better ways of producing a mousetrap, and they have been producing a better mousetrap. We've been spoiled by 40 years of relative luxury and prosperity. The people who run the plants in the United States sometimes seem more interested in their own futures than the future of the business that they are running. More news about leveraged buyouts and junk bonds and the like come out of our manufacturing facilities than about new discoveries and their economic potential. Leveraged buyouts stand as a symbol of the times. It's a way a raider or business leader gains control of a company with money borrowed against the stock of the company itself. You can make a great deal of money this way, but a leveraged buyout does not contribute much to the economy, to the economic well-being of the country. If anything, it leaves the American business community more vulnerable than it has been, soaked in debt. The leadership of the company spending its time and energy on questions of ownership and finance rather than the direction of the company itself. The American economy remains powerful. It's enjoying the longest period without a recession since World War II. Inflation has cooled off from a high of 12% in 1981 to just under 4% today. Joblessness has fallen. Interest rates have declined. Many have more to spend. The economy allows freedom and opportunity. But it's a strange period. The American economy has been supported to a degree by foreign investments and in the last 2 years by a 50% drop in the value of the dollar against major world currencies. What I fail to find in the American economy is the consistent will to face to the challenge of competition, to meet it head on. Often an agreement has been made, say with Japan, to limit the number of cars that can send in the United States each year. Instead of taking advantage of this opportunity to compete effectively in the American market, American manufacturers have simply raised their prices to match those of the Japanese goods. This failure of will is not a monopoly of business. I take it as symbolic and symptomatic of the absence of will that for 3 weeks led congressional and administration leaders to haggle over a debt reduction package. The country waited for their leadership. When they ended their commission work on November 3rd, leadership seemed to be sadly lacking. What was worked out was just short of outright failure. There is some evidence of a new spirit in American business. Some businesses have used their time wisely, and their increasing investments in time and equipment have increased productivity. But the question remains, will American industry generally have the will to buckle down seriously and get to work? Will it remain hypnotized by purely financial arrangements and stock ownership? Because of leveraged buyouts and the like, American business has been piling up terrific debt, which inevitably will drain off our ability to compete. Even junk bonds must ultimately be paid off. In terms of the economy, the Reagan administration legacy is clear. The economy has grown since 1981, the longest peacetime expansion since World War II. The misery index, inflation plus unemployment, is down about 11% from a peak of 21% at the end of the Carter years. But another result of the Reagan years has been those disproportionate benefits to the wealthy. Income tax reform is only one example. The gap between the rich and the poor has widened substantially. Income has become unequal in this period, more so than any other period since World War II. The poverty rate, 13.6% of the population under the poverty level, remains higher than it was in the Carter years. The number of children living below the poverty line has soared. There is no way that the president can escape his part in this legacy when he leaves office. Now, the president came to office determined to chop down the size of government, but he was of two minds. On the one hand, he sought to cut the domestic budget severely. On the other, he sought to increase the defense budget markedly. He succeeded in the second, but was less successful in the first. He felt the economy would be improved by allowing the rich more money so they could invest in the American economy and there would be a trickle-down effect. But the trickle-down has taken a long time, and the poor are, in fact, poorer. In spite of October 19th, the American economy is in fairly good shape. The American job machine continues to work. 315,000 found work in November, and 3 million found work in the first 9 months of this year. Now, to be sure, many of the new jobs are no longer the high-paying blue-collar jobs of the 60s and 70s. They are service jobs, which pay only slightly more than minimum wage. There's been a definite fall-off in the income of the lower middle class, and there's been wage restraint right across the American board. There's something wrong with a society where the wealthy are encouraged by tax reforms and other means to increase their wealth, and the poor and the lower middle class are discouraged. There's something wrong in society when you read on page one of an entrepreneur who's offering $1 billion for the leveraged buyout of a company, and the following page, a long article about homelessness in America. There's yet nothing wrong with the American economy that cannot be fixed. We have to reindustrialize. We have to think clearly in terms of competition. We must not assume that Japanese bond buyers will keep our credit markets sound. We cannot expect that the world will always be the path to our door. Why should it? We must take into account the less fortunate among us. The Reagan administration has made it much harder for the poor to claim their rights. On the basis of what's called supply-side economics, the administration argued that investment would have a trickle-down effect. The poor are still waiting for that trickle. It's easy to forget the poor, that nearly 15% of Americans and are concerned with stock processes, prices, and the like. They must not be forgotten. They're ultimately the measure of the decency of our society and of our economy. Amen.